Welcome to 60 Scales and the Truth, a podcast where amazing guitar players reflect on their lives and on how they got where they are today. My name is Niels Guns. I'm a journalist, podcast maker, and a guitar fanatic. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is someone who truly embraces the full spectrum of being a musician. Not only is he a great guitarist and composer, but he also worked as a musical therapist. That among many other things. His music made an impact on countless musicians. A musician who found and crossed musical boundaries. Welcome to this episode, Cynic's Paul Masvidal. Paul, when did you first realize that the guitar was going to be the vessel for your music?
Lifetimes ago.
Tell me. Tell me about the Paul who found that out.
Oh, well, I was in this body, I was, I think I was maybe 8 or 9 years old when I saw my brother's best friend come over who was playing, and they were working on rock songs and playing AC/DC and Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and all that stuff. And I would hear him in his room jamming, and I just thought, I want to do that.
You already lived in Miami then? Or
yeah, okay. This was in Miami. So it was just, I attribute it to my brother's childhood friend, Lance Troop, who was actually a really good player, a blues player. And I think he still plays a bit, but he didn't have a career in music. And I just did, you know, it's like one of those moments of triggers something in you as a child, and you think, that's what I want to do, you know?
Yeah.
And I immediately, I actually got a bass first, and then switched to a guitar. And yeah, it was, you know, it took some time to get to the point where I felt like it was a part of my body. You know, it takes...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. The first chord is awful, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it takes time to kind of get... But once I was spent some time with the instrument, I thought, okay, I have things to say, and I can use this tool to say them.
Because that's a magical feeling, right? To find that out.
I think it's a act of survival as a child. You know, I had to put a lot of. I was a very empathetic child, mm-hmm. absorbing a lot of chaos in the home, mm-hmm. and just a lot of instability. So the guitar became my friend. Mm-hmm. It was a place to kind of work through a lot of things. So it was therapy, you know, for me.
It's a safe place.
Yeah. It doesn't betray you. It's, you know, it's one of these things. It becomes a real instrument of survival. I mean, it's for me as a child, it wasn't like a hobby or something like fun. It was more just like, I have to do this, you know? Yeah.
But that's interesting, because the relationship only becomes deeper and better with the instrument, right? With the guitar, like, and
yeah, it probably brought out a more intense passion for what I was interested in as a musician, like, you know, the types of music, and what came out as a result was driven by that root, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't fun and games for me. It was like, I got to make this. I got some things to say, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't even realize what I had to say. You know, it's like a journey of, you're always discovering what you're saying. You don't really, you know, as an observer, it's like, it's all these points of view. And I remember in those early years, especially like by the time I started high school, I was really still writing about, you know, in reaction to the ways of the world. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of went more internal over, you know, I started to develop a relationship with my own mind and realize it was, the enemy is within, it's not out there, mm-hmm. you know? So it was like, I turned it around, and that's when I think it got more introspective.
Well, at what age was that, like that insight?
Well, the probably the feeling and that sense was quite young, you know, my teens, but where it actually translated into music and as a sound was later, maybe my mid to late teens, when I started to think, oh, there's more here. It's not just this reactionary thing or a political kind of point of view. And I'm saying even like, because it's funny, I'm speaking almost like about lyrics, but mm-hmm. it goes hand in hand with the music to me. You know, it's all kind of connected because the guitar is very lyrical. There's always a melody involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to write vocal melodies on the guitar. So mm-hmm. it's all connected, the words and the guitar itself.
But like you said, it became my friend and my safe haven, so to say. Did it ever disappoint you, the guitar as well? Because the guitar can feel different every day, right? I mean, that's the yeah. strange thing about it as well, right? But
I mean, I disappointed myself, I'm sure. I don't know, the guitar
maybe it's like
inanimate,
that. Yeah.
But
the guitar yeah. is the same, yeah.
yeah, but there's been moments for sure, especially, you know, I still encounter them as a musician that's actively practicing and trying to get better. You know, the relationship with the instrument is evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you don't want to pick it up,
mm-hmm.
but you do anyways. And you push through like what feels like you've just hit a wall and you can't get past it, you know,
mm-hmm.
but you still, I still pick it up, you know, I still try and I went through years of that. I mean, I definitely had moments where I thought, wow, maybe I'm not supposed to play guitar. Maybe I'm, cause, you know, I end up finding out that like all these things are tools, instruments of expression, right? They're ways for an artist to make something. And I was like, oh, I could draw, I could do other things mm-hmm. maybe. But then it was like, oh no, guitars feels like my body. It's like, it feels like, you know, I feel really connected to it. So it kind of, I always came back to it.
Is that because you say it's a part of my body, so to say, you played a headless guitar for a long time now. Is that also reason why you play headless guitars? Because because they're more compact, right? They're maybe easier to make it a part of your body as well.
Yeah, maybe. It felt, I mean, I really started playing headless because one of my teachers played one and I bought his off him, one of his Steinbergers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really my first way, you know, entry into having those guitars. And I used to play his at lessons and just loved how it felt.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the compact nature of it, it's assimilated more to the body because one of my first electrics was a massive Gibson V2,
mm-hmm.
which was just like almost the size of my body.
It's funny. I cannot imagine you with a Gibson V2.
Yeah. I was just a kid, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like what was around at a local shop kind of thing. And I just mm-hmm. thought, cool shape, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely, the body, the size, that smaller scale just feels more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Hey, and I looked up one of your first teachers was a guy named David Weisbrot, right?
Yeah.
And there's some YouTube videos of him playing. It's quite jazzy, bossa nova, a Latin kind of feel, things playing. Was he teaching you that as well? Or
yeah, he did everything. I mean, he was like a monster player who could just do mm-hmm. session work in around South Florida. He opened all those doors. We were like, you know, me and my other guitar player at the time, Jason, and other friends, I had other guitar friends, childhood friends, we all kind of studied with him and we would compare notes and we were all just like absorbing. It was just not only about the instrument, it was like a way of being.
Mm.
It was like he gave us books on spiritual things and, you know, taught us about how to think about music as a philosophy rather than just something you technically, you know what I mean? He was a real kind of, he understood the sensitivity as us as young artists and was able to kind of
mm-hmm.
convey something that really inspired us, which was, I owe so much to him really. Cause I had so many lessons where I was crying and frustrated and confused and struggling, you know, with home stuff or whatever was going on in my life. And he would just hold space. It was like, wow, what a teacher.
You know? That's super important, right? To somebody who does that with you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it helps for young children, younger people who are trying to navigate this, you know,
mm-hmm.
this incredible thing we're in. And then you have a teacher who's kind of grounded and has some clarity and has done some work on himself to kind of point the way, you know, and keep what's important in front of you. It was like he always just kept reinforcing what was important. And that's, I think, why I owe everything to him, really. I mean, at least there was other teachers, but Dave was a big one.
But you said it was quite chaotic back at home, and the guitar was for you something very positive in your life. Was it something that gave you the feeling like, okay, there's something I'm good at, something I want to do, something, the reason it's like to live, so to say.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember feeling lucky that I knew I wanted to do this, because there was a lot of other friends and people, especially you get into your late teens and early 20s and people don't know what they want to do. You know, there was always that question, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I was like, aren't I already somebody?
Yeah.
Do I have to grow up? Right.
Yeah.
But there's this, you know, profession and this idea of, you know, the way our society is structured, that you're supposed to get a job and do these things to fit into these molds. And I just didn't fit in any of them. But the music gave me like I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. This is, so it was a sense of knowing, like I had a place to. And I would say, I mean, I remember this, a lot of my childhood, while all the friends were going to the beach and to parties, I was practicing at home or playing with my bandmates or my drummer. Like we were, I think, odd kids in that we were so dedicated to music at a very young age. You know, it was really our joy.
But it's great to find kindred spirits as well then.
Oh, it's right? So rare. It's what I realized, to have those kinds of connections is so special, especially when you have that intuitive sixth sense with people. It's really empathetic and, you know, you read each other, you know, and that's, I don't know that you can teach that or, you know, it just happens.
Yeah, but it's also about being vulnerable towards each other as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
You have to be able to fuck up.
You're completely seen.
Yeah,
it's
a
completely vulnerable environment. Absolutely.
So when, because obviously you were quite young when you started Cynic, but can you tell me about those early days that you really were finding out like, hey, this, maybe you didn't even define it as such, like, oh, it's jazz, it's metal, and that's what, but can you tell me something about that journey when that kind of style came about, so to say?
Well, Dave was a big part of that, because we were, you know, started out, I was a classic rock kind of kid, and then classical, you know, I studied classical for a while, and then I got into like fusion and world music and pop and all kinds of stuff. But Dave, that one teacher, was turning us on to a lot of new music and jazz harmony and all that. And it was just expanding our ears. You know, I remember forcing myself to listen to jazz just so that I could hear the harmony. I could hear like the tonality of chromaticism. Cause then once it's like in your body, you can write that way. You know, you have to kind of be able to hear it organically. So I was forcing myself to kind of absorb that kind of harmony so that it would become a part of me. And I think that was probably post the demos, really right before we made Focus, was when we started to apply a lot of this more kind of broader harmonic sense and a more eclectic sound. And we started to realize, wow, we're not just pissed off little metal kids anymore. We're trying to say other things, and we're interested in dynamics and subtlety and nuance. And it was just a lot of things to consider rather than just full speed ahead kind of stuff. And so it introduced a lot of other elements and you could say colors to the music, you know, cause it was like suddenly there was clean breaks and just, yeah, more free. Actually, it just opened everything up, because suddenly it was like, wow, we can do anything. And to know that as a musician, that there's no boundaries, is extremely liberating, you know? Then you just do whatever you want. And the mind of a child, imagine, you just make the weirdest stuff ever.
Yeah, I see your face now even light up if you talk about that emotion, so to say, right?
Yeah, I'm connecting to that place as a child where it was so free. There was no boundaries, you know? Mm-hmm. That's really the, I think, the goal of music, or at mm-hmm. least for me, is to just mm-hmm. break the rules and make something new, you know, mm-hmm. try and do something new.
But if you're a kid and you have the feeling and your face lights up, right, if we talk about this, do you have, and let me think about how to ask this, do you have a way nowadays to go to that feeling of liberty? Like, okay, I need this and that, and I'll go there emotionally. And
I mean, I don't know that I can like flip it on mm-hmm. like a switch, you know. It's more about creating space for whatever needs to happen to arise. And if it shows up, I can open up to it and be receptive, mm-hmm. but also know that it's not always, do you know what I mean? It's kind of the muse visits you, you know, mm-hmm. and those, that moment of inspiration for me is very special, and I can turn on switches and play mm-hmm. as a, you know, be that guy if I'm to have a job or something as a musician, but it's not the same. Mm-hmm. It's like when you're creating from a place that feels like it's not even you, it's more of like you're an antenna, you know, mm-hmm. that's transmuting information, and it starts to almost feel impersonal in some ways, although it's so deeply personal. That's the irony, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, mm.
it's you and it's not you, so
yeah.
to say.
Yeah, well, because you hear it back. It feels, it's so raw and intimate. Then you listen back later and you're like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
That's not, I didn't do that, you know? Mm-hmm. I feel like that a lot about a lot of stuff. It doesn't feel like it's mine. You know? It's hard to explain, but it's extremely like, there's no person there, you know? You're more just like a vessel for mm-hmm. some sound. And then it's like, wow, this is a cool sound. Mm-hmm. I'll keep making that. If I can keep making things like that, that's cool. You know?
That is the magic about music as well, right? I mean, yeah. I remember Paul McCartney also saying something like this, like, it just visits me, right? All these ideas. And like,
yeah, you don't know where it comes from. I mean, we're literally arranging sound molecules, mm-hmm. you know, out of thin air, creating these shapes. And it's really mysterious, you know? It's not something you can manipulate or control.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but you have, I talk with other guitar players and they have like quite a routine, daily basic of playing, right? And then the inspiration will come or not. Mm-hmm. But for you, how does that work? I mean, you say it's, I cannot really control it, but like, can it be wherever you are or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's right wherever you go, there you are. So it's like, but it's.
No, but if you're in the street having a coffee and you're like, oh shit,
all
I
the
have
time.
To. Okay. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah. That happens. Mm. Most of the time it's away from the instrument and then you have to like get it down. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I always say it's like, for me, practicing is so much of it is being even away from the instrument, because there's that stuff, playing is more about chops and having fluidity and having things accessible to you. So you have a broad vocabulary and language to so if you're hearing something, you know how to act, like mm-hmm. pull it out, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of the actual creative process, it's, you got to go live your life, you know, mm-hmm. and you don't know where it's going to come from. Mm-hmm. It's most artists, I think, are doing research, you know, we're going out there, sometimes getting into trouble, sometimes, you know, looking for situations that are going to pull us out of our comfort zone because we're trying to stay in that place of feeling that.
Yeah, you need life for music, right?
Definitely. Yeah. I always tell, I haven't been teaching in a long time, but when I was young students, because I would get these young people who would just shred, mm-hmm. but they had never left their mother's bedroom, you know, their bedroom in their mother's house or something. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you've done enough practicing. You have to go out and get your heart broken and do some drugs or do something. You know, I mean,
don't kids advice.
No, I mean, but just go explore. No, but just to go.
So kids don't do drugs.
But go, you know, go live, go, take risks, travel, get out of your cocoon mm-hmm. and see the world. I mean, the traveling always helps the brain, right? Mm-hmm. You start to see, wow, there's all these different realities and fully realized people living their lives all over this planet. It's so good for our mind.
What I find interesting about that, if you travel a lot and then you're coming back to your own place, that's where the real lesson starts. Like, okay, you see the place right. where you don't think about these things that you take for granted. And then all of a sudden, you're not even at the place you traveled to anymore. Yeah. But then I find that super interesting how that works.
Yeah, you get some perspective for sure. Come home fresh. It's like, oh,
yeah.
Now they can have something to compare it to.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the chaotic phase in your life when you were young, right? So that also, in the perspective, gave you experience to make music as well, then perhaps.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, at that, like I said, it was an act of survival.
Yeah.
I was just playing to, because I needed somewhere to put all my confusion.
Mm.
I was lost and terrified.
Mm.
So the guitar became this sanctuary, you know, it was my safe place to just process
mm-hmm.
everything I was going through, you mm-hmm. know. It still is. I think I've learned how to make friends with myself better than I was then. I was really hard on myself.
You know?
And also thinking the external world was what was wrong with my life. And then you start to realize it's not, there's nothing you can do about that. All you can do is take care of what's going on in here,
mm-hmm.
how you perceive the events of your life. And I got a little gentler about that. I started to learn how to be friends with my past and my childhood and be a little, take it easy, you know, it's mm-hmm. okay. It's mm-hmm. okay. However it looked is all right.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't supposed to look any other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stop comparing it to other things. You just let it be what it is and then see, be grateful for a lot of things. There's a lot of positivity too. It's not just a
mm-hmm.
all hellscape, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just it's an ongoing journey of working with the mind and how it relates to reality and the story of your life, right? And what story do you want to tell? What mm-hmm. story are we constantly telling? So I'm careful about that now, you know.
But is that also, because I once spoke to you by phone, you probably won't remember. I just found a tape a few days ago. It's like 18, 19 years ago. We had a phone interview. You were playing in Holland. And you mentioned that, we talked about you being a musical therapist for a while as well, and that you work with people who are terminally ill, right? And you just took your guitar sometimes and just mm-hmm. played. What you just mentioned, did you also bring that feeling there, that feeling of intimacy and the guitar becoming your friend
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously like someone in that environment, anybody, you know, you put yourself around someone, you can see their relationship, they're setting the tone, right? We're bouncing energy off each other.
Yeah.
So like my relationship to the instrument in that room with somebody who's faced with the end of their life it's almost like it has nothing to do with me. You know, obviously it's like you're just in service of somebody's process and just trying to bring some ease to make them comfortable, whatever you can do, you know, to just bring ease. So there's not a lot of my stuff, my story. It's more just like, how can I be comfortable mm-hmm. with my presence in their presence? Because they're doing the big step.
Mm-hmm.
They're facing the end of their life. So
mm-hmm.
you become very small in that space, you know, mm-hmm. it's not about, there's yeah. no one here. I'm just, what can I play for, you know, and I'm just trying. And I remember, you know, I've been different instances, but I had one woman many years ago who had a liver transplant that she didn't make it, you know, but she had a few months where she was able to tell me what songs she wanted to hear and I would learn them.
Mm.
And it was just playing music for her, you know, which was really nice to be able to kind of do that with her. And you're there to make people comfortable. So there's not much of, you have to really get out of your own way and just show up for people, you know? It's about whatever they need.
But what pulled you towards doing that at that point in your life? Because it's also being musician.
I was afraid of death.
Mm.
And I wanted to get intimate with it.
Mm.
So I put myself around dying people.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just an opportunity to kind of meet it very directly.
Mm. Was there any particular reason at that moment? Because this was quite a long time ago.
Like, why did I, at that time...
Yeah, feel that you needed to do that?
It was... This was the early 90s in Miami, and at that time, a lot of the AIDS epidemic was kind of peaking,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people were around in the gay community that were dying, and even in where I grew up, in my own neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of guys were moving from New York to Miami. It was a whole situation that I saw as a young boy who was coming to terms with his own sexuality and terrified because I thought, wow, I'm going to die if I...
Mm.
So I had to like confront things, I guess, you know, I had... Yeah, and curiously, my first patient was an AIDS patient when I decided to do the work.
Oh.
He was a 34-year-old man, yeah, who was a beautiful soul, who really was a great teacher for me. He taught me how to do this because I was so scared, you know, to kind of go in and be, it was like, who am I to show up for somebody like this? But he just needed a companion. A lot of times, especially this agency I was with, they just needed neutral people because they're in the face of their illness and whatever it was, the family, all that stuff can be really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just this random person with no history that could just be their friend.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often the role you play. You're just like a fresh energy that they can process things with, and they don't have this, all these projections or history with and trauma, you know, it's a clean slate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he brought me in completely, which was so beautiful. Like we became best friends.
Mm.
So it was a nice kind of schooling. And he died really courageously, which was incredible to witness because a lot of people don't, aren't willing to kind of look at it that directly, but he was a real warrior, which was a real incredible teaching for me. I was like, wow, this guy is an inspiration. You know, I want to die like that.
Mm.
I've had a few of those, but not many. Most of the time it's pretty rough, you know.
But that for you as a musician, because it's not really, well, it is also being a musician, right? It's that's why absolutely. I mentioned in the beginning, it's such a broad spectrum of being a musician that you have done. I can imagine that gave you also a lot while making music after these sessions, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and it's not to say that my experience is any more special than anybody else's because it's all relative, right? But these were mine, and this has probably helped shape a lot of what came out, right? It influenced the sounds and the leanings, what was happening musically was obviously related to a lot of those experiences. Everything is, our whole life is kind of connected, right? You can't compartmentalize your work as a musician unless you're just, maybe some people do, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you put on an act deliberately, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really, to me, it's just an extension of being, of how, you know, how you exist in the world. Like, there is no separation, you know, it's not like that's this thing I do. It's like, it's just who I am, but there's no one there, you know, it's kind of, it's a lot of layers to it, without getting too philosophical, but yeah, it's definitely just a way of being rather than like, this is a thing I'm going to do and turn into a career and,
Yeah. But not many musicians who go on tour, make albums, you know, are in that kind of routine.
Yeah.
Go there, so to say, right? I mean.
Yeah.
Or maybe I don't know of it. I mean, maybe they do, but you just don't.
I mean, I've always been very intensely curious about the nature of reality. I mean, even since I was a child. And, you know, I remember my mother, who was into like witchcraft and stuff as a child, taking me to like esoteric bookstores. And I was just buying all these, she's like, get whatever you want, you know? And I would, cause she wasn't trying to force a religion on me. So it was incredible because I got to read all kinds of interesting. And I think what I did as a child is I intellectualized my pain. I went to books first, you know, to kind of understand it with my mind. And then the music was where it all drops down into your body. It's like, now you got to integrate your, it's talking about the heart and mind. It's like they become one organism. They become in sync. And that's how you make the sound, right? It's like, because sometimes the sound can be very mind, very intellectual, and that lacks heart. It doesn't, you can't feel it, right? You can say everything in one note, you know, just in one bend. It's like it's all there. You don't need a lot of notes. So it's always trying to remember that it's less is more in the context of trying to communicate something.
So that also, because Bart Hennephoff of Textures had a question for you. He basically asked this.
Yeah, this is my question for Paul. I'll try to keep it short. It's about songwriting and the mindset that comes with songwriting. So what I see in progressive music, when you start to write music, you can have two approaches. One approach can be, I go all progressive and everything that comes out of my fingers should be new and refreshing and not been heard before. Or on the other hand, you can go with sort of approach that you think, okay, I'll stick to my roots. I write something that might have been heard before. So you stick to your roots and from there you spice it up and add some progressive stuff. So I'm really wondering what would Paul's approach be in this, or maybe it's a blend of both. The reason why I say this also because I listen to a lot of progressive bands, but also some bands I don't listen to because they go too far. It's just too much new notes and new melodies that I haven't heard before. And but Cynic, for example, there's always some connection with the listener. Also, on the first time I listened to Focus, I had a connection. I heard things like, hey, I've heard this before. It feels good. So that's why I wonder what Paul's approach is in this.
I can relate to that very much, actually, the connection. Thank you so much, Bart, for your question.
Cool.
How do you keep the connection, he basically asked, with your heart, so to say, if you were playing complex stuff? Because then your head is there as well, right? I mean.
Yeah, I feel like it's just checking in with the body. Really just settling in and being in the body. And there was a book I read, funny, I'm going to use a book as a reference point, but it was called The Natural Classical Guitarist, I think. And it was, a lot of it was teaching you how to sit with the instrument and how to breathe when you were playing. So taking a breath, you know, inhale, exhale, like playing in rhythm with your body. And I feel like that was good training because then it gets you in sync with, you're not just all mind. You're kind of relating to what's going on. And I can tell when I pick up a guitar, whether I'm anxious, you know, it's an immediate device that tells you, you know, because based off what I even start to play immediately.
What do you hear if you're anxious? What comes out?
A lot of speed, a lot of fast notes.
You mentioned once in an interview that you heard if Alan Holdsworth, he was anxious, you notice him.
Yeah, we all know
speeding up.
A lot of guitarists will say that. It was like, oh, he was really nervous tonight.
Yeah.
Because he would just, it's insane. But it's so beautiful, it didn't matter.
Yeah, well, he's. I stumble if I start to talk about him, right? I mean,
I know. He's what a player.
Yeah.
He was really communicating something from beyond. It wasn't human. It was like alien, it was a real alien.
But it's interesting that you did feel the connection. Like, how must he have felt at that point or that point? Like, you could tell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think he was also, he was an introverted kind of person. He wasn't a real ham of a performer. You know, he was very in just reserved person. So I think if the instrument became this vessel, right? Just a tool to kind of express things, and you could hear it. It was like, oh, he sounds relaxed. He sounds, you know, but it was always so advanced. I mean, Holdsworth's vocabulary was from somewhere else.
What's striking for me with his playing is that it really took investment from me to grasp it. The first time I heard it, I really disliked it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, what is he doing? And didn't realize it was me, because not always music, it's not always the job of the musician. Like, okay,
yeah,
you know, it's my job and you'll have to like it or not. As a listener, you have to invest.
Yeah.
And he kind of taught me that as well. Like, it's me who has to learn.
And it's not for everybody. I mean, Holdsworth's stuff is pretty weird. It's pretty out there. A lot of it's going to go over most people's heads, I think, you know.
I still don't understand.
Yeah, but, I don't either.
But maybe a little bit, you know. So like, okay, just that realization broadened up the way you consume music, so to say, or listen to it or let it enter your ears, right? I mean,
yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned, because I'm quite intrigued what you said as the work that you did as a musical therapist. I had to cope with death in some way. Did that help you in 2020? Because that was a rough year on you, right? Because your two of your former bandmates died. Did that help you in that year?
I think what helped was having a meditation practice and being able to sit with a lot of discomfort, because I had to really be in a place where I was just explaining this the other night to the audience, actually, because I was thinking, you can't outsmart grief. You can't intellectualize your way through it. You think you can, and you might get busy with other projects and push it away.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't try to push it away. I leaned into it. And what happened was I was completely disassembled. I was like at the end of my rope. I thought it was my turn.
Mm.
You know, I went a few weeks there. I was like, it's my turn to die.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, they were like my mirrors, my reflections, you know. They were people I forged my identity with, especially Sean Reinert.
Yeah.
So we were really naked to each other, and we had this thing that, you know, this earlier falling out. So it was even more complex because he died and our relationship wasn't resolved. It was in a weird place. So it was like I had to kind of resolve all of that within myself, you know, without him in front of me, which is its own journey. But yeah, I think having just spent some time learning how to be gentle with myself I had some moments where I wasn't, where I thought, oh, now I have every excuse in the world to just obliterate myself, to be really self-destructive. Mm. Now I can do it all. I've had a life of tragedy. You know, it was like you get into this story of the victim. And then it's like, wait a second, no, they're still here. Their energy exists. Nothing really dies. I mean, the form dies, but there was just like this other way of perceiving my, like the relationship shifted. I still have a relationship with them. It's just not physical anymore, but it changed. It looks different now. But it took a while to kind of understand that, you know, that just because they're not physically here doesn't mean that you can't still have a relationship with these people.
And what role did the guitar play in that process of getting to terms with that grief or giving space for the grief?
Well, I couldn't pick it up for a little while. We were in the middle of a record.
Yeah.
And so I put it down and wasn't sure if I was supposed to even finish the record, and I went through all of that, and then I kind of came around and realized, okay, I wanna do this. And I, you know, I had done a lot of work with medicines with psychedelics, and I went and did a ceremony where they both appeared to me and gave me permission to finish the record. It was
the ayahuasca ceremony?
Yeah. And, you know, who knows what the layers are with something like that, but it was where I suddenly knew I had to finish the record.
Mm.
And it was like I had permission or something. It was not that they were ever not granting me, but it was all my stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. I was overlaying my own trauma and grief, and so I had to kind of just find a way through, you know. And I don't think I ever put myself back together. I don't think that I ever, you never come out the same from those things. You kind of are changed, but I know that it dropped me down deeper into like being more connected to what's important in my life and putting myself around people that I value and, you know, just being mm-hmm. really, the nature of impermanence became a little bit more upfront for me. Even all that, those years of the hospice work, it's still different when it's people this close to you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, I even say this, and it's not that your family isn't, because your family's your, you know, brother, sister, mother, father, but people that I made music with, the kind of music we made, it was so intense.
Mm-hmm.
It was so vigorous, the way that we dedicated ourselves. And so it was a really intense, you mm-hmm. know, connection. That's another thing post family, mm-hmm. you know, it's mm-hmm. in some ways more naked, more seen, more vulnerable, because it's accessing this root thing, this, you know, this essence of a creative process that doesn't even feel like you, but you feel vulnerable. So it's all of that that was mm-hmm. in those relationships, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I didn't know who I was or what I was supposed to do. I was like, is this like, what am I, who am I? And I'm still asking those questions.
But, nobody you know, really knows, right?
Yeah.
I mean, next day you're literally,
yeah,
some cells have disappeared or are another shape tomorrow.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's nice to, we cling on to things to feel safer about how we understand reality. But when you let it all just kind of, just turn to dust, it's kind of liberating, actually, because there's nothing to hold on to anymore. You're just like, okay, I have nothing to lose.
But that's also a magical feeling when you have that, like, if you really let go, like you don't have anything to hold, and then
right
things will come to you, right?
Exactly.
That's fucking weird how that works, right?
It's like this idea, if you're grasping, you're like suffocating, and you're trying to hold on too tight, you have to just, it's a practice. I mean, I'm doing it every moment, constantly trying to remember to just drop in, you know, it's like, and it's really like a groove in your brain. Every time you remember, you just, the groove gets a little deeper, you know, you just have to keep practicing. It's like, it's like training a puppy, you know, to just like,
yeah. Hey, you mentioned you were recording a record then and you couldn't pick up the guitar. That's the record where Pliny was also on, right? I'm curious. I'm trying to drag him in front of the microphone at one day in this series as well. But I was wondering what kind of connection as a guitar player you have with him, because he has also such, like yourself, such a amazing style, right? He's like one of a kind as well.
Yeah.
So what's your connection as a musician with him?
I connect with Pliny as like a fellow artist. Like, you know, when we get together, we talk like old friends about our gripes about the music business, whatever we're going through personally. You know, he's like a brother kind of energy. So it's like, we don't even really get into music talk. It's funny. It's more just like an old friendship, you know? Last time I saw him, we just went on a long walk and we just talked for a while. It was a beautiful day in LA I think he's really, he does have something to say as a guitar player. You can hear it.
Yeah.
And he has his own thing going on, and he's a real creative person. he has a lot of, you know, he does, that whole sound is his world, you know, he's mm-hmm. creating all that stuff, which is really cool.
But that, for me, the connection with Syndicate's quite obvious, because you guys, specifically when Focus came out, that was also some sort of new spectrum, and that's, hey, that's your sound.
Yeah.
Right? And with Pliny, I have the same. If I listen to, like, oh, that's okay, cool. That's that part. Like, oh, okay, yeah. That's his world. And
he's in his own world, yeah. Yeah, we met him because we were doing a show in Japan, and he opened. I think it was some of his first shows. Mm-hmm. And then we did a guitar clinic together and stuff like that. And that's when we became friends. This was in 2015.
Ah, okay. And you were like, hey, you also have an Atlas guitar.
Yeah. We were both Strandberg at the time. Yeah.
Hey, talking about other guitar players, I don't want to put you in a corner, but I'll be talking to Nili Brosh really soon. Is there something you'd like to ask her, perhaps, because it's a returning topic in this series?
I would ask her how, because she does a lot of different types of, she plays with a lot of different kinds of musicians. She's a very versatile player. And I would ask how she is able to keep herself, because she has to fit the mold of Danny Elfman and all these different projects that she's doing. And how does she maintain her own voice in the midst of all these different hats she's wearing?
That's a super interesting question. Thanks. I'm very curious what she'll tell. I'll edit the tape and I'll send it to you if she's answered that. We've come to the end of this talk, Paul. I have the feeling I can talk with you much longer, because this is just a mold. Like, it's 40 minutes and then it's something, in a way, artificial, so to say. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you reaching out. Nice to chat with you again.
Yeah, you probably don't remember the last time. I had to really dig back that. But thanks and have fun during your tour.
Thank you.